Hello there. I'm so excited to be with you. I have such visceral embodied memories of being in that hall, being in previous halls, being, way back, as Tim said, in a whole variety of different physical spaces. And it's it's so delightful to feel this continued connection with all of you, even though I'm not there. I have so many memories, really, of Seattle. The one that's popping up in my mind was I was staying with Rodney and Ellen and going out to meet somebody for lunch. And I walked out, I said to Rodney before I left his entryway, "Do I need an umbrella?" And he said, "No, it's not raining." And I walked out and it was raining. So I came back in and I said, "Rodney, it's raining." And he said, "We don't call that rain in Seattle." So I thought of all of you hearing about heat domes and like the bizarro world that we're currently living in and feeling for all of you. And I'm working on book number 12, by the way, Tim. So it's going to be a dozen, I'd say an even dozen, but I don't know if that's the end. But what really came to my mind to start with, I'm going to speak some. We're going to do some meditation together, and then we'll have, time just to hang out together with questions or comments from you. What came to my mind to start with was really book number 11, which was Real Change, and that came out September 1st, 2020. I had turned in the manuscript probably December of 2019. And I spent all of February in California traveling around and teaching. Came back to the East Coast in early March. The book was supposed to come out June 1st, I think. And I did a few programs in March in Massachusetts or New York. I was in New York City and I started thinking, it feels really tough here. It's like, can I touch that elevator button? Or, what about this? Or everything was so unknown. It was so tense. And I thought, I'll go up to Massachusetts for 2 weeks. And that 2 weeks turned out to be a year and something. And the book was postponed instead of coming out June 1st, it was going to come out September 1st. So I had a friend who was reading it, and now we're in the new situation, pandemic. So he was reading it in order to excerpt it. And he said to me, I really liked your book, but I kept reading those examples and thinking, that's what made you anxious? Wait till you see what's coming. So I went to the publisher. And I said, would it be okay with you, because there's now this delay, if I wrote a new preface and kind of try to ground the book in our current reality? And they said, okay. So I began writing this preface. And in writing the preface, my overarching question was to myself was, what's still true? Like in this time of shattered expectations and disruption and loss and grief and change, like what's still true? And that reminded me, the Sanskrit word dharma, which means many things. It's often used to describe, say, the Buddhist teaching or the way of things, the truth of things. One meaning of it is that which supports us, that which upholds us, that which sustains us. So, what's still true? What's holding us up when so much is falling apart? And that became my really deep investigation. I thought of something I had read about when the bomb dropped in Hiroshima. Even further devastation was around because this rumor came up that grass and trees and flowers would never grow again. It's like the cycle of nature, the laws of nature themselves had been destroyed. And as terrible as things were, in fact, people, they said, found a different ability to go on when that rumor was dispelled. And they understood something was still intact. Something was still whole, even as so much was destroyed. So that really is a profound investigation. And I would urge you all to just think about that now and then, you know, like, what's holding me up? What am I counting on? In other words, and we do that on lots and lots of different levels. We do it on a very immediate kind of level. It's like understanding, what have I been counting on for resilience? So I was part of this program for about 4 years through this place called the Garrison Institute, working with frontline domestic violence shelter workers and then directors and supervisors of shelters, bringing tools of meditation and yoga and so on. So we would always start out a program by asking people to do this exercise, either journaling or just as a reflection, so we can do it a little bit together now. Let's say journaling. In one column, we ask people to write down, what's the biggest source of stress in your life right now? Just to acknowledge it. And because everyone was working in the same field and often for many in the same place, sometimes that got centered on work, but it could just be life. And that was sometimes surprising for people, you know, instead of what they expected, like trying to dismantle such a terribly oppressive system, or the suffering is so overwhelming. It was more like bad communication with colleagues. So I think it's just interesting to notice, right? And in the second column, we said, write down or reflect on what you do. What's holding you up? What do you count on for resilience? What practices do you have that are helping you keep on going or have a sense of renewal, of starting over? And people wrote down all kinds of things. I think in 4 years, every single person wrote down, listen to music, although it was all different kinds of music. People wrote down, I get out in nature, or I have a strong faith tradition, or whatever came to mind. Sometimes it was like, I drink a lot, something like that. And then in the third column, we asked people to look back at that second column, at what they had just written down, and comment on it. So sometimes people would write down, I drink a lot, and then they'd write down, I'm concerned about that. I think I need to do something about that, or I think I need new tools. There was one time, not actually with that group, I took that same kind of survey. I was working with like chaplains and medics in the military, so I took that same survey to there. And somebody had written down, I go out in nature. And then in the next column, he put down, actually, I haven't done that in about 7 years. So that's like kind of a wake-up call too, right? Like, maybe we have tools, we have resources, we have habits, things that are actually leading towards resilience. And it's been a while, you know, since we last exercised them. So that's just all interesting information. And nobody had to disclose what they'd written down if they didn't want to. And we would say, well, we have some tools we'd like to propose you experiment with, which is meditation practice, both mindfulness and loving kindness, and mindful movement. Some people did choose to read out loud, you know, what they had, what they'd written. And it's so personal, really. I remember the one woman, she said, I watch a tremendous amount of American Idol. And I was just like laughing because I'd only seen it once. I was in someone's house and they they turned it on because they loved it. And I just found it like watching continual rejection. I thought it was the most like devastating show. I couldn't imagine watching that to get some relief. But there are a couple of points in there. It is personal. We need relief. We need a break. We need perspective. We need to do something so that we can feel some support. I think often of the stress dynamic, which is a dynamic. There's the pressure, the incident, the circumstance, and then there's the resource with which it's met. And we know that even when it isn't like such crazy times, you know, like you haven't slept all night and then something happens, it's very hard to cope. Whereas if you feel really rested, you feel like you have more energy reserves to draw on, very same incident. Or you feel alone, you feel isolated, unseen. It's very different when you confront something than when you feel you are part of a community, that you're not alone. And people sometimes hear this and they think, you know, well, you're suggesting we never try to change the circumstance where the stressor or the pressure and just focusing on developing that inner resource, which isn't true. I mean, I think we do try to change it to whatever extent we can. But first of all, if we're seeking change, coming from a place of desperation and I can't bear to be feeling what I'm feeling is not the healthiest place to be coming from. We don't tend to see options. Creativity gets cut off. It's much better to have some sense of resource, of resilience, so that we can then make some effort to seek change from a different place. So when I ask myself this question, what's still true? What are you counting on? I realized how much of that remained centered in my meditation practice in different ways. So not too long ago, it's getting to be half a year almost, had an anniversary. I did my first meditation retreat in Bodh Gaya, India. It started January 7th, 1971. So I had a 50-year anniversary, which is outrageous. I mean, it's so dreamlike. I can't even believe that. Nonetheless, it's true. And some of the things that became so important for me in that very first retreat are the very things I practiced. For example, my first meditation instruction was to sit and be with the in and out breath, just to feel the sensations of the in and out breath. I'm sure many of you have done that. And one of the things that's interesting about meditation is that there are lots of hidden lessons or treasures or skills that are actually being developed. Like if you had told me then, 50 years ago, what, you know, so many of you heard me say over and over and over and over again, which is, the really important moment in that particular practice is not, it's not a question of like gripping the breath, you know, so that your mind won't wander. The really important moment happens after your mind has wandered. You've been lost, you've fallen asleep, you've been overcome, whatever it is. Learning how to let go gently, wherever our attention goes. Learning how to begin again with some kindness toward ourselves instead of ranting and, you know, just being down on ourselves forever and calling ourselves a failure, being able to let go and begin again. It's what one of my Tibetan teachers called exercising the letting go muscle. That was more important than being able to accumulate all those breaths. I never would have believed that. In fact, I didn't believe it because I heard it. It took a long time to realize, oh, that's right. And 50 years later, I find myself practicing that. And so many times people say to me, how do I stay mindful all day long? Or if they've done a retreat of some kind, how do I keep the level of concentration that I attained on the retreat? And I always say, that's not going to happen. You're going to lose it. You're going to get overwhelmed. You're going to yell at your kids. You know, something is going to happen that wasn't in your deepest aspiration. And nonetheless, it won't last as long. You'll come back sooner and sooner. You'll truly be able to begin again with heartfulness, sometimes with lessons learned or needing to make amends or whatever. But nonetheless, now compare or contrast what we normally do. And I'll go back to using meditation as an example. You know, you're sitting, let's say your intention is to rest your attention on the feeling of the breath. A few breaths in, your mind starts to wander. You catch yourself thinking, and that begins the diatribe. I can't believe I'm thinking. No one else is thinking. Why am I always thinking? They're not thinking. They're sitting here. They're all beatific. They're sitting here in bliss. I know they're in bliss. They're probably enlightened or very close to enlightened, or maybe they are enlightened, or they're sitting bathed in brilliant white light. I don't have any light. I'm thinking, you know, I'm so stupid. I'm so bad. They're not thinking. Maybe they are thinking, but they're thinking beautiful thoughts. They're thinking thoughts of love for all beings everywhere. And I'm thinking the same old stupid thought. I'm so bad, right? That's what we, just out of habit, out of conditioning, might tend to do. So what's happened? We've sometimes added a considerable period of time to the original distraction. And we're so demoralized. We're so exhausted. We don't feel that wherewithal, that sense of inner resource to come back, to start over. So how about if we don't call ourselves a failure? How about if we focus on that kind of resilience of starting over? That's sort of the whole point. And we do that so many times in a single day. We do that over and over and over again in life. We need to do a course correction, or we need to acknowledge a mistake, or we've fallen down and we need to get up, or so, you know, let someone else help us up. We need to start over. And it's kind of the rhythm of life itself. And it was one of the things I came to love about meditation practice, was that the itty bitty little packages were actually working on very profound levels for big life lessons. So that's part of what I've been counting on over and over again. And different elements of that in mindfulness, being able to be present with whatever feeling, let's say feeling is arising, could be sensation, could be something else, but let's say feeling, without all of the attendant judgment. I don't have the cup in this room. People have taken to making me cups and sending them that have things I normally say a lot, which is one way of me seeing what I normally say a lot, like begin again, you know. And one says, we feel what we feel. Another one says, something's just hurt. Something's just hurt, you know, like not because we're resistant, not because we have a bad attitude, not because we have to change our thinking. Something's just hurt. And we feel what we feel. We have to kind of allow every feeling the dignity of its existence. That doesn't mean we want to dive into every feeling and be just enveloped in it. It doesn't mean we want to act on every feeling. But we feel what we feel, and we need to allow the integrity of that. Part of what we learn, you know, in mindfulness, of course, is we call it sometimes that place in the middle where maybe a strong emotion has come up. And normally we go into one of two extremes. One is that kind of dive into it, to identify with it. This is the only thing that's real. This is who I truly am. This is all I will ever feel. This is permanent. This is solid. or just so absorbed in it that we just act sometimes later to our regret. The other extreme is feeling ashamed of what's going on, and we want to push it away. We're trying to deny it. And it doesn't actually work. You know, that's the big problem with it, because we just get tighter and tighter and tighter until we explode. Many of you have probably heard me say my favorite example of mindfulness, my favorite definition, came from an article many years ago now in the New York Times, which was describing one of the very early bringing mindfulness into the classroom programs. It was a pilot program in Oakland, California. And somebody asked the kid, it was a fourth grade classroom, so he's maybe 9 or 10 years old. The journalist asked, well, what is mindfulness? What is mindfulness? And he responded by saying, mindfulness means not hitting someone in the mouth. That's what mindfulness means. And I thought, that's a great definition of mindfulness, because what does it imply? It implies you're recognizing the anger when you're starting to feel angry, not after it's built and built and built and built. If that's what we tend to do, then we'll probably hit a lot of people in the mouth, because life can be very frustrating. But on the other hand, if you can't stand what you're feeling and you try to repress it and deny it, you will explode. It's not going to work. And so that's where we say mindfulness is this place in the middle. You can fully be with what is, but there's some space. Space doesn't mean like I see cold distance. It means space. And in that space, maybe options will arise. Creativity will arise. Different ways we might deal with the situation or what we're feeling may arise. Like I like to think of that kid in that space thinking, hit someone in the mouth last week. Didn't work out that well. Maybe I'll try this. And actually, I have a story. I keep putting it in my books. I think I can't put it in another book, but I love the story, which is why I keep writing about it. And it's from my friends from the Holistic Life Foundation in Baltimore. The Holistic Life Foundation for years now has done a program bringing yoga and meditation into inner city schools. And they told me a story about a little girl. I think she was even younger. I think maybe she was like 7 years old, who had done one of their programs. And this girl was like a fighter, you know, and she was bullied. She was teased. She was in, you know, some bad circumstances, but her response would be to like knock kids out, you know? So she was always in big trouble. And she went through the program. So one day, my friends told me they walked into some public place like the auditorium or the cafeteria. And she had this other little girl up against the wall, holding her by the throat. And then she said to her, you're just lucky I know how to meditate. She dropped her. She went off and just like sat in the corner and composed herself. It's a great story, isn't it? You know, we don't want to be passive. We don't want to be complacent. It's not like we never want to respond to anything. We don't necessarily want to be driven by emotions we don't even understand. And that's sort of the main point, actually, classically, of mindfulness. You know, a lot of how we teach mindfulness these days, or it's taught, is really about the tremendous benefit we all could have from more fully inhabiting our lives, not always multitasking, sometimes like drinking the cup of tea while you're just drinking the cup of tea. You can smell the tea, you can taste the tea, you can feel the warmth of the cup. You're not also checking your email. You're not also on a conference call, right? Just having these moments of more fully living is an incredible benefit for us all. But classically, mindfulness was really much more about insight or wisdom. not just inhabiting our lives, but understanding our lives. Being able to look directly at our bodies, our minds, the relationship of the body and the mind, the relationship we have with others, and come to a different understanding. Some of that insight is very personal. You know, I've talked a lot through the years about sitting in meditation and looking at my own fear, for example. Timely topic. And what we do in mindfulness is, first of all, we pivot. You know, when we have a strong emotion of some kind, we're usually just fascinated by the object, the story. If we have strong desire for something, like I'm going to buy a new, I don't need anything, let me think. I'm going to buy a new Zoom light. We spend all our time thinking, do I want this feature or that feature? How'd that person look when I saw them use it? You know, that kind. And we don't often just kind of flip our awareness around to notice, well, what does it feel like to want something really badly? So that's the first thing we do. We just like, oh, what is this? Not why is this here and what am I going to do about it? But like, what is this? We look in our bodies, what is the effect of that emotion? We look at kind of the movie of the emotion, the way it plays out. And so what I've seen looking at my own fear is that unlike the world's pronouncement, which of course is also true, that we're afraid of the unknown, I get afraid when I think I do know and it's going to be really bad. And it's the stories that I generate that really get me going. And even in the midst of that kind of arc of anxiety, if I remind myself, you know what? You don't know. That's actually relief. Then I feel openness. Then I feel space. So that was like a personal insight that was very useful. And we also come to understand the kind of complex nature of many of these feelings. You know, if you're looking at strong anger, maybe you also see fear. Maybe you also see sadness. Maybe you also see grief, so many things. And almost always, I think, if we can hang in there and be with that feeling, somewhere at the core of it, we often find a sense of helplessness. And if we can come that far through the anger, then recognizing that helplessness, we might resolve on something to do. Some act, even if it seems really small, rather than be in that whole construct and suffering and simmering, perhaps without a good end, you know, toward action. We see a lot of things, and we also see universal truths about all these feelings. They may be strong, they may be intense, they feel like they're forever, and they're not. Everything arises and passes away. If we look at the heart of anything, we will see change. It's not a solid thing. It's all these many things coming together, coming apart, moving, shifting. So anything we are looking at is actually an alive system. And that's a very different relationship to anything that we're going through. It's not to dismiss anything, remember? Allow every feeling its own dignity of existence, but it's really getting empowered. You know, if our relationship is one of presence and balance and interest toward whatever arises, we will have insight, we will have greater wisdom with which to make choices or to decide upon action and so on. So that's a part of course, what I've been counting on. I mean, it's so interesting how merciless we can be toward ourselves, toward whatever we're feeling. You know, the arc was pretty clear. you know, although there are, of course, individual differences, it's like you could see the anxiety building and then the grief and then the fear and then the anger and then the exhaustion. And then I forget the word Adam Grant used. It's languishing. Then we were all languishing because we couldn't pick up the energy to come out of the exhaustion. And then, you know, and now it's like people are having a much harder time again sometimes, you know, because this has all gone on for a while and there's so much else happening as well. So to be able to recognize that, you know, like this was years ago before the pandemic, I was talking to somebody who was very down on herself, like, I don't know why I'm not more together. You know, I should be more balanced. I should be more even tempered. I should have more going for me. I don't know why I'm so untogether. So I asked her to write out a list of everything she'd gone through in the previous year. And she chose to draw it instead of write it out. And it was terrible, you know, like my cat died, my house burnt down, I got estranged from my brother. And it was like a lot of pictures there. And I said, well, look at this, give yourself a break. No wonder, you know, this is hard circumstance. This is really tough. And yet, if we have some compassion for ourselves, and work with different skills, we can have more ability to deal not only with circumstance, but with everything that we're feeling. And that seems crucially important. And what else I've been counting on? I also saw that it's really essential to deeply and honestly acknowledge suffering and at the same time be able to take in some joy, to rejoice in even very small things. Because otherwise, you know, again, we just get so tired and it's all so overwhelming. And, you know, we're not building that sense of resource that we really could be. Barbara Fredrickson, who's a psychologist, she's a researcher at the University of North Carolina. She's done a lot of research on what she calls positive emotions, what I call positive states, because I'm not sure they're all emotions. Gratitude, loving kindness. She's done a lot of research on loving kindness. Equanimity or balance. Interest, curiosity, you know, a sense of wonder about things. And she came up with a theory, they call it the Fredrickson broaden and build theory. And she's saying that if we cultivate these qualities, first of all, our perception broadens. You know, instead of feeling so locked down and like I can't breathe and, you know, there's no room and whatever, you know, when things are really, really tight, everything broadens. We have a sense of expanse. We don't know what's going to happen, but we have some sense of possibility. And what's really freaky, but true, is that when they did those studies, they also tested people's peripheral vision, and it got broader from cultivating, say, gratitude, something like that. So that's the broadened part. And we know that, right? When you're in the grip of fear, you know, your mind is not delightedly thinking, well, if it doesn't work out this way, maybe it'll work out that way, right? It's not going to work out. Everything shuts down. So the more we can broaden, the more we will see possibilities. And the other part of her theory is built, and that goes back to the idea of inner resource, that if we feel alone compared to feeling like part of a community, it's going to be harder to deal. But if we cultivate that sense of community, of reciprocity with people, of reaching out to people, we will feel growing within us a kind of strength. And I thought her work was really interesting, and I often quote it because it's easy to think of those states as kind of superficial or even stupid, you know. I know a lot of people, for example, feel a resistance to consciously cultivating gratitude, saying it'll make you weak, it'll make you settle for crumbs, you know, you won't fight for anything, and in a good way. But actually, it does the opposite, apparently, you know, according to research and just, you know, one's own experience, it builds that sense of resource. So you don't feel utterly depleted and incapable of meeting the moment and capable of trying. And I know that these things are practices, you know, like gratitude, to continue on with that. I, you know, often say, first of all, if I'm suggesting it, which is usually as a practice, like try to write down 3 things a day that you're grateful for from the day. And they don't need to be magnificent, you know, it can be very small, but it counts. And I also say, as is true, this does not come naturally to me. You know, my personal conditioning, my familial conditioning, my cultural conditioning is such that I am so much more likely to think about things I can complain about than what I have to be grateful for. It's just where my mind goes. So it takes like a conscious intentionality to say, okay, that is all true, but what about the good in this day or in me or in my life? And to include that, it takes intentionality, not force and not coercion, but actual intentionality. And so we practice. It's also true that as hard as it may be for us to look honestly at painful feeling, it's hard for a lot of us to be with pleasure and delight and wonder and joy. And sometimes we're just so distracted, we don't take it in. Sometimes we have these really perfectionistic standards about what an experience should be. So nothing is ever good enough. And I'm sure many of you have heard me tell the story about my friend bringing me in Washington, D.C. one year to that area in the district where there's like this concentration of cherry trees and they all bloom at once. And that's cherry blossom season, which was like this big tourist thing. And so we got there that year and I was like, just awed and full of delight. I thought, wow, like so many of these delicate pink blossoms and they're so beautiful. And then my friend said, oh no, it's past the peak. And I thought, oh no, I'm having a bad experience. This isn't good enough. Right? So how many times do we do that? Or, and I'd say, maybe especially in a time like this, which can be so difficult, we feel guilty. It just doesn't feel right to take joy in something. But again, you know, I was teaching at different times with my friend Bob Thurman, who was a professor of Buddhist studies at Columbia. He just retired. So I just taught with him a few weeks ago. He told me he's now known as a professor emeritus. So, and he's a scholar and a translator. And I noticed that in teaching with him, just about his favorite word was realistic. And I kept thinking, that's not exciting, you know, like realistic, it's kind of bland, you know. But of course, listening to him and understanding it more, I began to appreciate that being realistic is like being in harmony with the truth. And anything else, it's another cup that someone sent me, is like banging your head against the wall. So the cup says something like, banging your head against the wall is never a good idea. Right? So coming in tune with reality is very important. And the reality is we need to replenish. We need to get perspective. We need to be able to begin again. We need to take in the joy. We need to build that sense of resource. That's reality. And so it's very important. So I've got kind of the centering or the concentration of, say, being with the breath. I've got mindfulness as a resource, the ability to be with some really difficult feelings and some really joyous feelings also, and to be able to honor them and absorb them. And then the last sort of thing I feel I find continuously in my meditation practice is a sense of connection. And I've often considered that it's not only connection to ourselves, but it's connection to this larger vision, connection to one another, a very profound sense of interconnection in our world. I've always thought it was so funny, you know, because it can look like meditation can look like the most solitary activity on earth. It's like you may be all alone. You may have your eyes closed. But somewhere in doing it, something happens so that we open to this understanding. There's much greater empathy. There's much greater compassion. There's a deep, deep knowledge of how our lives are connected. Like one of my favorite things to do, going into an organization or a company or something to teach, is to ask people, how many other people need to be doing their job well for you to do your job well? Because it's true, isn't it? Like I was talking to a physician who ran a large medical practice in a hospital, and he said, you know who I have an increased appreciation for? It's the cleaning staff. And I thought, well, yeah. You know, when I actually posed that question the other day to a group, and they weren't into it. So I said, okay, if you're not working from home, how did you get to work? Were you counting on a train? Were you counting on a bus driver? Were you counting on someone else? Were you counting on a car mechanic having fixed your car? If you're working from home, who are you counting on? You know, we had a big storm here the other day. Internet went out, power went out. It was another life for just about 4 hours, you know. And then power came back, internet came back. I thought, oh, okay, now I can function. Or I went on with this group, did you eat today? You know, like if you don't grow your own food, like how many people, just as, you know, an active imagination, how many beings are involved in you're having that like plate of tomatoes or something, right? Lots of beings. We live in an interconnected universe, and there's a deep, deep knowing of that and appreciation of that. The consequence of that knowing is like the force of loving kindness and compassion. So here we are, you know, having been through a lot and maybe going through a lot and relying on something, hopefully on very skillful aspects that we can strengthen. So let's do some meditation together. I don't know if you want to just like stretch or take a really short break, and then we'll practice. So I'm going to guide you through a mindfulness practice using the feeling of the breath as kind of the anchor. If the breath doesn't work for you, that's fine. If you're experienced in meditation, you can use whatever has worked for you. And if you're not, I would suggest something that's happening anyway, you know, like another sensation in your body that you don't have to search strongly for. But I'll guide it as though it were the breath. You can sit comfortably, close your eyes or not, however you feel most at ease. And we can start by listening to sound. It could be the sound of my voice or other sounds. Of course, we like certain sounds and we don't like others. But you don't have to chase after it to hold on or push away. Just let it come, let it go. If you're not responsible for responding to the sound, see if you can wash through you. And bring your attention to the feeling of your body sitting, whatever sensations you discover. See if you can feel the earth supporting you. See if you can feel space touching you. Usually we think about touching space. We think about like picking up a finger and poking it in the air. But space is always touching us. It's already touching us. We just need to feel it. Bring your attention to your hands and see if you can move from the more conceptual or abstract level, let go fingers, to the world of direct sensation, picking up pulsing, throbbing, pressure, whatever it might be. You don't have to name these things, but feel them. And then bring your attention to the feeling of your breath, just the normal, natural breath, wherever you feel it most distinctly. Could be the nostrils, could be the chest, could be the abdomen. You can find that place, bring your attention there, and just rest. See if you can feel one breath. Without concern, for it's already gone by. Without leaning forward for even the very next breath, just this one. And if you like, you can use a quiet mental notation like in, out, or rising, falling to help support the awareness of the breath, but very quiet. So you can really bring your attention to feeling the breath, one breath at a time. And if sounds or images or sensations or emotions should arise, but they're not all that strong, if you can stay connected to the feeling of the breath, just let them flow on by. You're breathing. It's just one breath. if something comes and it really whirls you away, you get lost in thought or spun out in fantasy or you fall asleep, truly don't worry about it. You can recognize that you're gone. See if you can let go gently and just begin again. And when you feel ready, you can open your eyes or lift your gaze, and we'll end the meditation.